this is going to the Supreme Court. First, they have to decide whether to take it. Is that right?
That's correct. So the first thing we are doing is we're filing a petition for a writ of certiorari, and that's the justices decide whether this is a case that they're going to review this term. Four votes are necessary to take the case up for consideration.
And what would this mean for you, Alan Leverett, as we begin to wrap up? I mean, you've been living with this case now for several years. What kind of response have you gotten in Little Rock and around your beloved state of Arkansas?
Julia pointed out, most people are still unaware that this is the law because it was passed through without any fanfare, without any real news coverage. And so most people, when I tell them or they ask me about it, and I explain it to them, they just kind of look at me blankly and they say, what does that have to do with Arkansas? And it has nothing to do with Arkansas. It has everything to do with culture wars that are being waged in this country, particularly by the Republican legislatures, particularly ours.
With us, Alan Leverett, publisher of the Arkansas Times and heirloom tomato farmer, Brian House, ACLU senior staff attorney, and Julia Baca, director of the film Boycott. She also made the film Naila and the Uprising, which just premiered at the Fisahara Film Festival at the Algerian refugee camps of the Sahrawis. That does it for our show. Happy belated birthday to Robbie Karen. I mean,
this is KBOO Portland, volunteer powered community radio. I'm Aaliyah, and I'd love to give a huge shout out to my mom for being my biggest cheerleader. Bye.
Prison Pipeline is a radio program dedicated to educating the public about the Oregon criminal justice system. Topics include incarceration and reentry, addictions and mental health, elections and laws, victims' rights, and criminal justice reform. The program presents a unique understanding of the criminal justice system, addresses the root causes of crime, and challenges the status quo. It seeks to promote awareness and activism in order to foster a safer, healthier, and more just society.
Prison Pipeline airs on Monday evenings from 6:30 to 7 p.m. on KBOO Portland. Check us out every week. If you miss an episode, you can stream it later. Just go to kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. More info about upcoming shows and events related to the prison community can be found on our Facebook page, Prison Pipeline. Be sure to like us.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler unveils his plan to ban houseless camping and open mass encampments. A new ballot measure could mean serious consequences for Oregon legislators who walk off the job. And three suspects have been arrested for a shooting on the Colville Reservation in Washington State. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, October 24th, 2022. I'm Michelle Coppola. Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler has announced unfunded plans to criminalize houseless camping in the city. Wheeler made the announcement at a press conference on Friday with City Commissioner Dan Ryan. They want houseless people living on the streets to move into mass city-sanctioned camps or campuses. He said previous efforts to set up temporary shelters have not worked because city officials could not force people to use them. Wheeler and Ryan say they plan to bring five resolutions to council this week. Those resolutions would create government-approved camping sites, accelerate the creation of affordable housing units, and set Portland leaders up to ban camping on city streets. No cost estimate was provided in the resolutions, but some estimate the plan is likely to be extremely expensive. It's not clear whether Wheeler and Ryan have the support from other government agencies, nor where the money for their plan will come from. Wheeler has asked Multnomah County and the state to help pay for some of those increased services. It's also unclear who would run those city-sanctioned camps. The mayor thinks national homeless services providers might be willing to operate large-scale sites here in Portland. Wheeler meets next week with the group Urban Alchemy, which is contracted with the City of Los Angeles to provide restrooms and cleaning services to people living outdoors. Right now, Oregon cities and towns cannot ban camping unless they have enough shelter for people sleeping outdoors. That's because of legal precedent in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. Wheeler's plan says they will build at least three designated camping sites that will initially serve roughly 150 people each. The plan is for these camps to eventually house up to 500 people each. The city wants to phase out outdoor camping 18 months after getting funding for these sites. Housing justice advocates say large, government-run camps are inhumane. They compare them to internment camps. Issuing fines to homeless people or jailing them for not having housing doesn't solve the issue or make individuals more likely to find housing in the future. That's according to reporting by Street Roots earlier this year. Another one of the five resolutions calls on city officials to create 20,000 units of affordable housing by 2033 and to build up a land bank of 400 publicly owned sites on which multifamily housing could be built. Other city commissioners, like Joanne Hardesty, reportedly were not given enough time to review the plan to support or oppose it before Wheeler and Ryan went public. Oregon ranks near the bottom in terms of access to mental health care, and it has a high prevalence of mental illness. Nurses in the state say low staffing makes their jobs especially difficult. Eric Tegedoff has more on the story.
The need for investments in Oregon's mental health care system is urgent, some nurses in the state say. According to a study from the nonprofit Mental Health America, the state ranks among the worst, at 49th, for the combined factors of highest rates of mental illness and lowest rates of access to care. Emmy Grasser is a member of the Oregon Nurses Association and a registered nurse on the Senior Psychiatric Unit at Providence Milwaukee Hospital. She says she serves patients with complex needs, but there's a lack of staffing on her unit.
In order to keep the dignity and great care for our patients, we have to have that available to us. We have to have those resources of extra bodies, extra security available to us so that we can keep the patient safe.
Grasser says there are not many care options for older Oregonians with mental health needs, and the demand is set to grow as the state's population ages rapidly. Grasser says her unit has faced consistent understaffing. She says the impact from the lack of investments in the mental health system is rearing its head at a critical time.
This is pertinent specifically right now in this time because this is around the time of the pandemic, and I think we're seeing repercussions because of it.
Grasser says it's hard to isolate patients on her unit because of its open layout. When a patient recently tested positive for COVID-19, they had a hard time transferring him and felt like Providence wasn't prioritizing someone with mental health needs. Grasser says two other patients on the unit ended up getting COVID.
It's unfortunately easy to see the stigma wrapped around mental health. It's easy to see that physical health and medical needs are superseding right now mental health needs.
For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
City Commissioner candidate Rene Gonzalez is claiming he's endorsed by the Northwest Oregon Labor Council. But according to one delegate, the council voted against endorsing Gonzalez. The council represents 100,000 members of AFL-CIO unions in Multnomah, Washington, Clackamas, and Columbia counties. On October 17th, a roll call of members voted no on endorsing Gonzalez, 16,000 to 13,000. But some campaign materials mailed to voters included the endorsement of the Labor Council. The logo has since been removed from Gonzalez's campaign website. Oregon leads the nation in legislative walkouts, but many voters are tired of watching their legislators waste time and money by not showing up for floor sessions. Ballot Measure 113 is an attempt to end walkouts by those state representatives who think the easiest way to avoid losing a vote they don't agree with is to simply avoid going to work. KBOO's Ray Bodwell has these thoughts. By the way, the opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
You might be surprised to learn that Oregon, long considered one of the bluest states, has something closely in common with Indiana, Tennessee, and Texas. We're one of the only four states that require the 2/3 of our elected representatives be present to establish a quorum when the legislature is in session. Every other state requires a simple majority for quorum. But in Oregon, as in the other three states I mentioned, if 2/3 of the members of the Senate or House don't show up, no work can be done. So far this century, there have been 8 walkouts by the minority parties that have brought legislative business to a standstill in those 4 states, and Oregon has the dubious honor of being responsible for 4 of the 8 walkouts, one by Democrats in 2001, and the other 3 by Republicans in 2019, 2020, and 2021. But if passed, ballot measure 113 should bring that practice to a halt. The measure doesn't reduce the quorum from 2/3 to a simple majority, but it does add an amendment to the state constitution that says that legislators with 10 unexcused absences from the floor sessions will be disqualified from holding office as a legislator in the term following their current term of office. I think that lets them off easy. Most of us would be fired on the spot if we tried to skate by with 10 unexcused absences from our jobs. We live in a representative democracy, and sometimes when your side is in the minority, it's going to lose. That's how democracy is supposed to work. The side with the most votes wins. But when the minority party walks out to prevent quorum, they have effectively disenfranchised a majority of the state's voters. By voting yes on ballot measure 113, you're telling elected representatives to show up and do the job that they were elected and paid to do, or find another job. For KBOO, this is Ray Bodwell.
Political ads and messaging are inundating Washingtonians as the November election approaches. Oddly enough, people's fear of death is an integral part of how some people make their political decisions. That's according to some researchers. Eric Tegedoff has more.
It's the political season, and Washingtonians are being flooded with messages ahead of the midterm elections. Curiously, our anxiety over death could play a big role in how we react to those messages, and even whom we vote for. The Seattle-based Ernest Becker Foundation has analyzed how its founder's theory explains our political motivations, according to Brian Burke, a psychology professor at Fort Lewis College. He says most of our political decisions are not made with the rational parts of our brains, but are instead more emotionally based.
When we're reminded of our own death, our preferences tend to change. We might support different candidates based on death anxiety than we would have had we not been triggered or reminded of our own death.
Burke says this can play out a few different ways in elections. For instance, traumatic world events such as September 11th have been shown to cause people to tend toward more conservative leaders, often for their messages on law and order. Other research has shown even the thought of immigrants moving into someone's neighborhood can cause them to think more about death, and thus take a harder stance on immigration. Burke says terror management theory, which was developed from Ernest Becker's research on death anxiety, finds people who are unconsciously thinking about death are more motivated to want to fit in with their peers or some larger group. But he says there's a way to push back against the ways the fear of death affects our decision making.
We can slow down and consciously and explicitly make more rational decisions about things. And it involves doing just that, reflecting on it and thinking through our opinions on an issue and taking some deep breaths and thinking, okay, how do I really feel about this?
Burke says if you are so inclined, you can analyze how politicians might be using the fear of death this campaign season.
When you're inundated, as you will be, with radio and television and other YouTube ads for political candidates, really think about what are they trying to get at in you here? What message are they trying to send?
For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Former President Donald Trump told a Texas crowd that he will run again, and Liz Cheney calls out election deniers. With those stories and more, it's Nadia Ramlagan with 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
In order to make our country successful, safe, and glorious again, I will probably have to do it again.
Former President Donald Trump told supporters at a Saturday rally in Texas he'll likely run for president in 2024. Trump also continues to spread 2020 election fraud conspiracy theories. Liz Cheney is criticizing Republicans who campaign for election deniers. The Wyoming Republican congresswoman called it indefensible to back claims that the last presidential election was stolen.
No one of any party should be voting for people who are election deniers. They're telling you that they'll only certify an election they agree with.
Meanwhile, the Trump Organization goes on trial for tax fraud in New York today. The real estate company is accused of helping top executives dodge taxes on rent-free apartments and luxury cars. Trump has called the case a political witch hunt. In Arizona over the weekend, the Maricopa County Elections Department reported two armed individuals in tactical gear and masks watching over a mail-in ballot drop box in Mesa. Arizona Republican candidate for governor Carrie Lake has been attacking the integrity of mail-in, early, and absentee voting.
Our Constitution says election day. It doesn't say election season, election month. And the longer you drag that out, the more fraught with problems there are.
Repeated and extensive investigations have found no basis for election fraud claims in the state. And two voters have just filed complaints of voter intimidation to Democratic Arizona Secretary of State Katie Hobbs. Hobbs is Lake's opponent in the race for governor. A recent survey by media outlet The Griot and the Kaiser Family Foundation found inflation and the rising cost of housing are the top economic concerns for Black voters. But Temple University professor Mark Lamont Hill says voting suppression continues to be a top issue.
7 in 10 Black voters are worried about voter suppression interfering with a fair and accurate election in their state, says something significant. 46% say they've had to wait in long lines to vote in the past. Tells you a lot about the experience of Black voters.
Democrats are scrambling to reassure borrowers about student loan forgiveness after a federal appeals court temporarily blocked President Joe Biden's plan to cancel billions of dollars in debt. Biden is criticizing Republicans of hypocrisy for opposing student debt relief while accepting Paycheck Protection Program money during the pandemic.
Republican members of Congress and Republican governors are doing everything they can to deny this relief, even to their own constituents.
I'm Nadia Ramlagan for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Well, it's not often you hear a story about a human versus bear attack where the human lives to tell the tale, but it happened over the weekend when a Washington State woman fought off a black bear. She'd let her dog out early Saturday morning near Enchantment Park and Blackbird Island in Chelan County. The bear charged her, and she fought it off. She sustained non-life-threatening injuries and says she actually punched the bear right in the nose, prompting it to run away. She's being treated at a Wenatchee hospital. Black bear attacks are rare, but not unheard of. Unfortunately, it did not end well for the bear. Wildlife officials killed and removed the animal where the attack occurred. Two of her cubs were found and were transported to the Paws Wildlife Center. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. You'll want to stay tuned after this newscast for a special election edition of Coast Range Radio, which will be weighing out Oregon's midterm elections in terms of climate action. At 6 p.m., it's Labor Radio. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline, where they'll be interviewing Executive Director of the ACLU of Oregon, Sandy Chung, about Measure 112, which would remove slavery from the Oregon Constitution. Then at 7, it's Exploration with Michio Kaku. Tonight's weather, rainy with a low of 46. Tomorrow, that rain continues with a high of 55. Today in history, Annie Edison Taylor became the first person to go over Niagara Falls in a barrel. The quote of the day is from Taylor, who said after emerging from that barrel relatively unscathed, quote, "If it was with my dying breath, I would caution anyone against attempting the feat. I would sooner walk up to the mouth of a cannon, knowing it was going to blow me to pieces, than to make another trip over the fall." A new book helps parents have the climate talk with their kids, and it stars a squirrel named Coco. Dr. Anthony Leisowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leisowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Lots of parents wonder how to have the talk with their kids. Not that talk, the climate talk.
We decided to put our heads together to try and think about what is the best way to tell young people about climate change.
That's Jeremy Wurzel, a psychiatry resident at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. He and his wife, Lena Champlin, an environmental scientist, worked with a panel of psychiatrists from the Group for the Advancement of Psychiatry to write a children's book. Called Coco's Fire, Changing Climate Anxiety into Climate Action, it's about a squirrel named Coco who feels scared when she learns about global warming. Coco's father helps her learn how to cope with her feelings, and he introduces her to a community of activists and changemakers who help transform her anxiety into hope. Wurzel says the book is designed to help parents talk with their kids about climate change and teach them that solving the problem does not rest solely on their shoulders.
And we wanted to flip that narrative a little bit and to say, it's not just on you. You are not alone in thinking about these things. In fact, there's a thriving local, national, and global community already thinking about these issues. Come join this thriving team.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
LGBTQ Americans have increasingly seen their rights in the political spotlight and as the target for candidates and states with hostile legislation and condemnation. Advocates say this is an important time for candidates to be transparent about their stance on the issues. Roz Brown has more in New Mexico.
In the past few years, the LGBTQ community has watched hard-won rights erode, and many fear worse is yet to come based on the outcome of the midterms. From Florida's so-called Don't Say Gay legislation to approved investigations of parents of transgender youth in Texas, states have passed laws to undermine the rights of countless Americans. Equality New Mexico Director Marshall Martinez says the outsized reaction is frightening.
We're sitting in, from what I can tell, one of the most dangerous times for LGBTQ people since the 60s and earlier. In terms of attacks and folks feeling like they have to go back into the closet and young people facing mental health crises.
In overturning constitutional protections for abortion, Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas suggested the court should also look at the 2015 case that legalized gay marriage. In New Mexico, Democratic Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham, who has consistently advocated for LGBTQ rights, faces Republican Mark Ronchetti, a former TV weatherman, on next month's ballot. Ronchetti does not address gay rights on his website and has not shared his views publicly. Martinez feels, at a minimum, such candidates don't think the LGBTQ community is important enough to talk about. Or, worse, they don't want their views known.
We think that LGBTQ folks in New Mexico deserve to know where the candidates stand on our issues, and we're clear where this governor stands, but we have no idea where her opponent stands.
Martinez believes with people just coming out of the pandemic and now struggling with economic issues, many want someone to blame, and the LGBTQ community is a convenient target.
And I think that it is easy to scapegoat, especially LGBTQ folks and the teachers and guidance counselors who are supporting us. And this creates an opportunity for people to be distracted from what's really making their lives difficult.
This is Roz Brown, New Mexico News Connection.
Authorities say they've arrested all three suspects in the shooting deaths of two people on the Colville Reservation in Northeast Washington. With that story and more, it's Daniel Montaño with National Native News.
For National Native News, I'm Daniel Montaño, in for Antonia Gonzalez. Authorities say they've arrested all three suspects in the shooting death of two people and the shooting of an officer after a day-long multi-agency search on the Colville Reservation in Northeast Washington. KHQ News reports the search began after the Colville Tribal Police Department responded to a call about a shooting in the small community of Keller on Thursday. Police found two people dead at the scene. A tribal officer pursued a vehicle that matched the description provided by witnesses. He was shot in the arm during the chase. A news release from the tribe says he was transported to a hospital for medical care and is now in stable condition. The campaign manager for an Arizona candidate for governor is drawing backlash for a tweet that included an illustration of a bloody ancient human sacrifice, along with the words, "Happy Indigenous Peoples Day." The Arizona Mirror reports Colton Duncan, who works for Republican candidate Carrie Lake, posted the image October 10th of a bygone ritual by Mesoamerican civilization that lived nearly 2,000 miles away. Lake had previously described Duncan as the most important person on her campaign. The tweet went largely unnoticed until a Democratic lobbyist and campaign consultant called attention to it. Native leaders condemned the tweet and are calling for a public apology from Lake. Gila River Indian Community Governor Stephen Rowe Lewis called it racist garbage and says, quote, "Arizona's native peoples deserve better." National Committee Woman for the Arizona Democratic Party, Debbie Nez Manuel, who is Navajo, says the tweet is inexcusable. Arizona is home to 22 federally recognized tribes. Former state representative and Navajo tribal member Sylvia Laughter has died. As Arizona Public Radio's Ryan Heinches reports, she represented part of the Navajo Nation at the state capitol for 6 years and was the first Navajo woman to serve as a lawmaker from her district.
Laughter was first elected in 1998 to the Arizona State House and represented a vast swath of rural northern Arizona that included many of the tribal lands in the state. According to Navajo Nation President Jonathan Nez's office, she obtained crucial funding for programs that benefited tribal members. Laughter was the founder of the Navajo Code Talker Memorial Foundation and led the effort to construct bronze monuments to the revered soldiers in the tribal capital of Window Rock, Arizona, as well as the city of Phoenix, the state capital. She also sponsored legislation to create the state's Navajo Nation license plate that still provides transportation revenue. Navajo Nation Council Speaker Seth Damon says Laughter pursued justice and accountability and fought for her community and the tribe during her tenure. He says Laughter secured more than $20 million for education, veterans, and elders. According to a family GoFundMe site, Laughter had battled COVID-19 for 10 months before her unexpected death on October 15th. They write that Laughter was a, quote, advocate for freedom and truth. Funeral services were held over the weekend. For National Native News, I'm Ryan Heinches in Flagstaff, Arizona.
Marjorie Mejia, longtime tribal chairperson for the Litton Rancheria of Northern California, died unexpectedly of natural causes last week. She was in her 60s. The Richmond Standard reports during her 27-year tenure as chair, Mejia helped develop the small Sonoma County tribe. She established the San Pablo Litton Casino, which made the tribe self-sufficient. She also secured a homeland by building a master-planned community in Windsor. Mejia helped expand infrastructure, businesses, investments, housing, and health care. She was recognized across the country as a distinguished leader for her hard work and devotion to advancing her tribe. For National Native News, I'm Daniel Montano.
On November 9th, the U.S. Supreme Court is scheduled to hear Brackeen v. Holland, a case that questions the constitutionality of the Indian Child Welfare Act, or ICWA, ICWA. It was created to address the epidemic of Native children being forcibly removed from their families and placed into non-Native homes. Mark Richardson has the details.
A case before the U.S. Supreme Court has Native Americans concerned that the outcome could revive a centuries-old practice of separating indigenous children from their families. The court will consider the constitutionality of the Indian Child Welfare Act, known as ICWA, a 1978 law aimed at ending the practice of placing Native children in non-Native homes or sending them to Indian boarding schools in Arizona and other states designed to civilize them. Dozens of Native tribes and ACLU chapters have filed briefs urging the court to uphold ICWA. Teddy Simon with the Northern California branch of the ACLU says many tribes still consider the separation practices cultural genocide.
They were physically beaten and abused, prevented from using their native languages, engaging in any kind of tradition or culture. Their hair was cut, their names were changed, kind of anything that was indigenous about them was scrubbed away and removed.
The case was supported on appeal by conservative groups who claim ICWA gave tribal nations rights not provided to other racial minorities. Native advocates fear a reversal could change how the federal government interacts with tribal nations on major issues. Simon, who serves as an advocate for racial justice and is a member of the Navajo Nation, says many Native Americans believe that when possible, keeping a Native child in their indigenous culture is in everyone's best interest.
All kinds of studies have been done showing that Native children have much better life outcomes across all of these indicators when they have the ability to be connected to their culture and their language and their heritage.
Simon adds that many Native Americans believe the case isn't just about children's rights, but is also an attack on the power and authority of tribal nations to defend their gaming rights, restore tribal lands to reservations, and manage their water rights in the Colorado and other river basins.
This has the potential to be the most important Supreme Court case relating to Native American people in our lifetimes. If the Supreme Court is to rule ICWA unconstitutional, would have potentially devastating impacts on tribal sovereignty and the existence of Native nations.
I'm Mark Richardson for Arizona News Connection.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News from Monday, October 24th, 2022. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Please call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem and Ray Bodwell. The producer is the intrepid Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Eric Tegadoff, Nadia Ramlagan, Roz Brown, Mark Richardson, Daniel Montano, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Michelle Coppola. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you'd like to become a member and support your local community radio station, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Coast Range Radio.
Welcome to Coast Range Radio, a production of the Coast Range Association. I'm your host, Michael Gaskill. Ballots are out for the 2022 general election, and it's no exaggeration to say that this is the most consequential election for Oregonians in years, if not decades. 3 out of 6 of Oregon's seats for the U.S. House of Representatives are considered toss-ups, where either the Democrat or Republican could easily win, and the race for governor is anyone's guess at this point. To put that in perspective, Republicans haven't held the governor's seat since 1986, and our federal delegation to the U.S. House could swing from a 4-1 Democratic majority to a 4-2 Republican majority. In the state legislature, Republican dark money groups are pouring unprecedented money into local state Senate and state House races. Now, we at the Coast Range don't make any endorsements,